everything had changed. Like, it was like my whole kind of axis had shifted. And it was like, actually, this, I don't want to be the center of my world. Anybody that ever met my sister, so Liz O'Donnell was her name, could attest that she was just this absolutely fantastic person. She was my absolute go-to for all things advice. She was very present.
Welcome to Psychologically Speaking with me, Leela Age. I'm a psychologist and researcher for hire, and also the facilitator of The Reflection Room, a group coaching space. This season, our theme is Expect the Unexpected, and we have already heard from some wonderful women who have spoken to us about things that have happened to them that they never anticipated would happen. I can't wait to introduce you to our next guest. We've got Chrissy Orson joining us, and Chrissy is a wellbeing consultant. She specialises in supporting organisations to look at psychological safety for employees and increase their wellbeing and retention. If you've listened to my podcast for a while, you'll know that I'm a huge fan of psychological safety, so I can't wait to get into that conversation. Chrissy is also a psychotherapist and coach. She supports clients who've experienced trauma to feel psychologically safe again themselves. And one thing that I didn't know about Chrissy until I was stalking her on LinkedIn earlier is that she's also a school governor. We're going to talk about that because it's such a rewarding role and a lot of parents get thrust into it. Chrissy, welcome to the Psychologically Speaking podcast, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I love your accent. Whereabouts in the country you are from?
So I live in Saddleworth, part of Oldham, so kind of between Manchester and Huddersfield.
I lived in Manchester for over a decade, so whenever I hear a lovely accent from either Oldham or Bury or Bolton, it always makes me feel like I'm at home. So Chrissy, what is it that prompted you to get in touch and to say, I want to talk about something unexpected that's happened to me? What can we expect to hear from you today?
So for me, the unexpected for me was a significant period of loss, 21. And that led to some really major changes for me, kind of career, life, ways of thinking, ways of showing up in the world, all hit around the same time. So that's what I would like to talk about today.
And so this would have been a period which was, were we coming out of lockdown?
We children weren't back in school. Lockdown was very much alive and kicking, and everything felt very isolated and very small, which made things really interesting to deal with.
Yeah. So obviously letting listeners know that we are going to talk about death and loss and grief and bereavement today. You're a psychotherapist. I feel very comfortable having this conversation with you, knowing that you're happy to talk about this. But if anyone listening needs any support, I will put some details in the show notes of places and spaces and organisations that you might want to reach out to. So Chrissy, do you want to tell us a little bit about what happened, who your family member was, how that has changed things for you?
So in 2018, I started a new job working for a local authority supporting education settings to have a whole school approach to mental health. Everything was fairly settled. We'd moved house the year before. Everything was fairly kind of relaxed. And then in the December of that year, my older sister was diagnosed with a really rare form of cancer, cancer of the bile duct, which apparently is supposed to be male, over 70, quite often associated with heavy drinking, smoking, obesity, things like that. And my sister would have been 6 and had run a half marathon 2 weeks before she was diagnosed.
Wow.
Yeah. So as a family, that absolutely floored us. She has 4 children, so there was kind of a lot kind of going on for us all. We were really lucky that in Manchester, one of the specialist surgeons, is actually based, so she kind of had surgery and went into a period of remission, which was fantastic. We always knew that it was a type of cancer that doesn't really stay away. At some point it will reoccur, and at the end of 2020 that happened. So we entered kind of a bit of a funny stage where she was obviously kind of terminally ill. There were still lockdowns. There was some flexibility around caring. I was doing my best to support with her family and things, along with her husband. But that meant that I was kind of going backwards and forwards to support them, whereas my children kind of were not able to. Then in early 2021, they stopped all treatment. and she passed away in February 2021. Anybody that ever met my sister, so Liz O'Donnell was her name, could attest that she was just this absolutely fantastic person. She was my absolute go-to for all things advice since her mum died in 2009. Me and my other sister largely turned to Liz for any sort of advice. She was very present. She was kind of the first person other than my husband to hold both of our children. And she was kind of very, very involved in our lives, kind of sister, auntie, friend. So she passed away in the February, which was horrendous. It was absolutely awful, even though we knew that it was going to happen and it was expected and it was awful. And we were kind of waiting for it. So I kind of went into work one morning and then, I walked downstairs into my kitchen and sat at my dining room table like everybody was doing at that point for work. And at some point, I got a phone call from my brother-in-law that said, like, you need to come. So I kind of ended up putting an out-of-office on, which was really odd because I didn't really know what I was putting an out-of-office on for. I was very lucky in hindsight. I think I was very lucky that I was with her when she died. I was with her, my other sister, her husband and her children. We were able to be there. And it was kind of a proper defining moment. I'd had to have some really difficult conversations with my children who would have only been five and seven. I had to kind of explain to them, firstly, that Auntie Liz was going to die, which was a horrendous conversation. Had to really put a lot of, like, all the learning that I have around how to explain that to a child, and then had to explain to them that she had died. Then it was her funeral a couple of weeks later, and the day before her funeral, I got a phone call from my dad. My dad had been, like, massively hit by her death. You know, I don't think any parent thinks that they're going to outlive their child, do they? He was, at the time, fit and healthy. He was kind of walking most days, you know, doing all his own shopping, cooking, cleaning, things like that. He said he'd had a fall, which never happened before. He kept saying he had this pain between his shoulder blades, and the doctor kind of seemed to think it was like grief, you know, kind of holding on to pain, things like that. Which, you know, we didn't really have any reason to think otherwise. So the morning of my sister's funeral, my dad phoned my husband, which was really unusual. He never phoned my husband. He always phoned me. Keith was kind of a bit of a kind of afterthought almost, as much as my dad loved him. And so he phoned my husband and asked him to go down. And at this point, my dad couldn't move. We'd had to, he couldn't get himself up on the sofa or anything. It was really, really difficult. And we had to kind of summon a little kind of team of friends to basically help get him to the funeral. We had to borrow a wheelchair. It was horrendous. By the following morning, my dad had lost all sensation in his legs and we had to ring an ambulance. At this point, he wouldn't have any of it. My dad was pretty much the, what you would class as white coat syndrome. Didn't like doctors, didn't like hospitals, would avoid them at all costs. So he ended up going into hospital and we were told that his spine had collapsed from a secondary tumour, from a cancer that we didn't know he had. He didn't know he had. He'd had no symptoms. So I was able to go into A&E to take him kind of a bag. But after that, we weren't able to see him at all. He was taken into hospital and was admitted. We didn't really know what was going on. I was getting lots and lots of phone calls from various different specialists, and was eventually kind of given got a phone call to say that they wanted to bring him home and that he'd signed a DNR in the hospital. It was all very kind of traumatic and was still very much in adrenaline mode, to be honest. My children's school were really, really helpful. The head teacher actually kind of phoned me and he said, like, can we take the children back into school early because it will help you? And I was like, no, it's fine. Actually, yeah, that would be really, really helpful. Because it's what we do as women, isn't it? We kind of go, no, it's fine. I can get on with this. It's fine. It's no problem. It was a problem.
Was this point where schools were only partially open for children of maybe key workers? Yeah. And presumably then, when you're saying we were allowed to go into A&E, but then the rest of the hospital must have been quite closed off for you. They were making exceptions, weren't they, for people who were on palliative care and stuff, I think, by that point. But yeah, it's trying to put ourselves back in that place, you know, which was, a strange place.
It was so strange. And I mean, I went to see him. Well, I didn't even go to see him. We were allowed into the hospital for a meeting with a social worker. And we were allowed in to see my dad for a few minutes, but it was like full PPE, aprons, face masks, like face shields, everything. It was awful. And it was awful for me to visit for like half an hour. So kind of, I can only imagine what it would have been like being there, being so frightened. So we eventually, he came home and we were told kind of it could be weeks, it could be months. But about 6 weeks after my sister died, my dad passed away. So I'd had some kind of interesting moments, you know, kind of while we were getting ready for him to come home and things. And I was talking to somebody who used to manage my manager. He rang me up and I was saying, like, you know, I'm going to look at carer's leave and see if I can go back to work part-time and see what flexibility they have. And he told me, and I mean, it sounds really harsh when I say it to somebody else, but he's a very lovely person. Mm. He just said, you need to get a grip. He said, you are not replaceable to your family, but you are replaceable at work. You need to be with your family because you will regret not being with your family if you're not there. And that kind of really stuck with me. I had to take some time off after my dad died, and it kind of all blurred into one, which raised a whole load of questions around kind of bereavement leave and how often should you be allowed to have bereavement leave, like, and to lose relatives so closely together. And I mean, my manager was really, really supportive, but because I worked for a large organisation, it's numbers, isn't it, rather than individuals. Yeah. So I went back into work. Everything had changed. Like, it was like my whole kind of axis had shifted. And it was like, actually, this I don't want to be the centre of my world. And I was going back into schools as they started to open, and I was working with them, and I really, really enjoyed my jobs. I loved the relationships that I had with, you know, head teachers and mental health leads and other kind of schools and things that I was supporting. But it wasn't lighting me up the same way. I felt like I could only kind of scratch the surface. And part of that was due to kind of budget cuts and things like that. But it was also because with budget cuts, you get spread thinner and thinner. I wanted more in terms of, I wanted more to be able to have more time with my own family. I wanted to be able to look after my own health, because I had this realization that my sister never made it to 50 and my mum was only 61 when she died. What am I going to just work myself to the point where I'm not well? Or do I want to be able to enjoy things now and be able to create a life where I can create moments of opportunity that I can have time off with my children, that I can take the afternoon off to go and watch a gymnastics performance, and I can go on, take a day off to go and take my son to the cinema because he's off school and my daughter isn't, you know, those sorts of opportunities. I wanted to be able to create those now, and it completely shifted what was important to me. I'd said to my husband, you know, if I've not found another job by the end of the financial year, then I'm gonna jump and just go self-employed. Now, what actually happened was I found a job. Ironically, I was offered the job on my sister's birthday. So I found a job, and I asked to go 3 days a week so that I could start building my own stuff. And I did that I stayed in that role for kind of about just over 12 months, probably about 18 months, and during which time I got from 3 days a week to 2 days a week, and then I went fully self-employed. And, well, I mean, anybody who tells you going self-employed is a really good way to give yourself any free time. It's probably not. But that's probably not the moral of the story. It didn't give me any free time, really, but it does give me more flexibility. And it means that if I want to do my work after my kids are in bed, I can. If I want to schedule LinkedIn posts at 6 a.m. before on my way into the gym, then I can do. And if I want to finish to take my daughter to gymnastics, can. Or I want to kind of take time off with them in the holidays, I can do those things. And I'm not kind of constrained by other people. And it's meant that I can work in a way that works for me. So I still work with my individual clients and I love it. But it's allowed me to also take some of that, the learning from my time working kind of whole school to different organisations, and talk to them about things like policies and procedures. You know, it's not the sexy approach to staff wellbeing. You know, it's not going to look good on your Instagram, but it is the stuff that makes the really big difference. Because, you know, if something happens, like, you know, you have an employee who has a family member who dies and they're told that they can have, you know, 3.2 days because it's this relative, it doesn't go anything towards what your relationships are, then you lose that connection with your staff. They don't feel safe, they don't feel supported, they don't feel wanted, and then nobody's getting their best out of their staff.
You described your whole axis changed when you returned to work, and I think that's such an interesting metaphor to use. So if we think about where your axis was pre Liz and your dad dying and where it is now, what has shifted most for you?
Being able to do the stuff that I really enjoy and being able to create a life and way of working that works for my family. So many organizations do things like flexi time, but it's not all that flexible. It's flexi time, but only between 8:30 and 5:30. And you can only earn up to one day. And if you earn more than one day, then no one's got time to take it. You know, that never really kind of worked for me. And sometimes I might take a day off during the week, and it might mean that I end up kind of writing training on a Saturday. But I do that at a time that works for me. Mm. And it means that I can do it whilst doing things at home after a football match or something like that. And it means that I can kind of put my family first, and I can put like my health first as well, because I was really struggling when I was at the local authority, like just before COVID. I have two chronic health conditions, and I had a really significant flare-up of one of them that causes kind of chronic back pain. And like, I'd landed myself on crutches, and we had to go and have kind of injections into my spine for about a week before lockdown, which was a really really interesting experience, traveling to London at the point where nobody else was going, and standing on a platform at Euston Station in rush hour, and there being six of us. It's really odd.
Yeah.
But being able to kind of put things in place to be able to make my health kind of a priority rather than something that I was just kind of like shoving in along the way and hoping for the best. Being able to kind of take the time off when I want to. Being able to say kind of like, in summer I'm hoping to take like 3.5 weeks off work, which I've never done. I've never had 3.5 weeks off since maternity leave. But actually, it's like my opportunity to do something really amazing with my family, because, you know, my kids aren't going to be little forever. They're not going to want to go on holiday with me forever. I mean, I kind of hope they do, but, you know, I would really like the opportunity to make those memories whilst I've got time to do that.
Do you think you would have moved into self-employment had your sister and dad not died when they did?
I'm not sure, if I'm really honest about it, because my dad was of a generation where kind of, you know, work for a local authority, it's a job for life, it's stable, it's secure, which it's not anymore. You know, there's been so many redundancies and things like that in kind of across Greater Manchester. So I don't know whether I'd have had the same level of support. But also, I mean, I was really lucky in a position that it allowed me just enough kind of financial freedom that I could go, actually, I can make this work. You know, if I can't make it work, I've got kind of like 6 months that I can kind of get by for. So there was that. It also allowed me the opportunity to kind of create an office at home and things like that, which has all helped in terms of, you know, my outgoings and things as well. I think I would probably have done a level of self-employment, but I think I would probably have held on to an employed role.
Mm.
Is my kind of gut feeling.
It's curious, isn't it? When I speak to women as part of the research that I'm doing at the moment, many of the women that I speak to don't suddenly wake up one day with a passion to go self-employed. It happens because it's the alternative. It's the alternative to becoming burnt out or trying to manage procedurally everything that's happening. There was something interesting as you were talking earlier, when you were retelling what had happened around your sister, Liz, and your dad. And it was that kind of procedural, this is what happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. And I was thinking, it sounds like you were somebody who was very much moving through it, holding stuff and moving everybody along what felt like an inevitable conveyor belt. But when you look back now, with your training as a psychotherapist, and I suppose with all of your experience of trauma, and how do you think you coped then?
Well, I mean, kind of thinking about it, I stayed at my job for 2 years after they died. What happened was basically for the first year, I think I just kept going. I think if I'd have gone to me as a therapist and talked about it, I would probably have talked about manic avoidance, which is the kind of, let's just keep busy and let's keep going and it will be fine. Because death's really weird. There's like loads of admin associated with death that nobody really tells you about. Like, we were trying to empty a house that my dad had lived in. It was our family home. So we'd lived there since I was 4 or 5. So by the time my dad died, I think he'd been there 36 years, I think we decided. So trying to empty that level of house. And I don't think, other than getting rid of my mum's clothes, which like me and my sisters had sorted, I don't think he'd really ever got rid of anything else. You know, we found things for him. My dad was a plumber's merchant. I found 50 brass outside taps. You know, like, what am I going to do with these? We did find some really hilarious things. Taps. Four toilet seats. Like, the toilets that we didn't even have. I felt like I didn't really have any choice other than to just keep going. But As the house sale went through, which was an absolute nightmare, probate was ridiculous. It took absolutely ages. Our buyer's house sale fell through twice. But when it eventually went through, I literally, I hit a wall. I remember going into work. By this point, the schools were open, and I delivered some training in a school. And I remember somebody telling me that the training was really, really good. And I'd done like two lots of training. I did kind of something and then some staff wellbeing training afterwards, so I was doing their inset. Mm. And I came home, and just as I was turning off the main road, my boss rang me and she was like, "How did it go?" And I said, "Yeah, it was great. Da, 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 da." And she said, "Are you all right?" I just burst into tears. And I was like, I can't do this. I can't do this anymore. I can't keep going. I don't know what I like. And I just absolutely went to pieces. And I mean, I think I'd literally hit the wall, not even like metaphorically, like literally hit the wall. I didn't know what I was going to do with myself. And I was lucky at the time I was having some supervision, reflective supervision from an organisation near me. And it was kind of through a project that I was managing. And I got quite kind of friendly with the two people who ran the organisation. And I rang one of them and I was like, "I need some extra sessions. I need some extra sessions. It needs to be with her." Because basically I said, she already knows everything that's going on. I said, "And if I have to go and find somebody and wait, I think I'll be able to pull it back together. Yeah. And I won't actually be able to start kind of working on the stuff." And I said, "You know, if I go and work with her and I try and tell her that I'm fine, I think she will call bullshit and she will make me go there. And that's what I need." So I was really lucky.
Can we just pause there? Knowing when is the right time to do the work and to have therapy and to sit and have those conversations is a bit of an art form in itself, because
probably about 3 months sooner than I did.
Yeah. And during COVID, about the similar time that you're talking about, I was working in the NHS at the time, and I was helping to set up a trauma-informed service. So I was in and around practitioners, clinical practitioners who did supervision, and our whole thing was trying to get people in for psychological support at the right time. And I don't think I'd ever appreciated how challenging that is, because there's that period where perhaps you have gone through loss, and we had women who'd gone through loss, and it's too soon. And I didn't think that was a thing. And then clearly there is the period where people have tried to just kind of carry on, and that's potentially where unhelpful behaviours and thoughts and intrusive thoughts come in. It gave me, you know, an understanding, how do we, as women who are carrying and spinning plates and juggling loads of things, how do we notice when we need to talk?
So when you're talking around grief and things like that, a lot of organisations will talk about, you know, you need X number of months to pass before you start accessing support. And I think that is the case in general, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily a blanket thing. So I think the thing that we're looking at is that grief isn't a mental health issue. Grief is a natural process that everybody needs to learn how to go through. What they need is people around them. They need support. They need people to help them be resilient, because nobody can be resilient on their own. It's one of my absolute bugbears of the term. So they need that kind of practical support, somebody who can help them emotionally and things like that. And quite often that is friends and family. But not everybody has that. So I think sometimes I've worked with clients where they've needed that support earlier because they haven't got anybody. Yes, it is a process that we all need to learn how to go through. But if you haven't got anybody to support you on that process, how do you learn? And I think it's also different if you've got things like traumatic grief. So, you know, I take clients from victim supports, homicide service, and, you know, I've worked with people who are bereaved by suicide, various other traumatic situations where you end up with kind of grief needs you to remember somebody. It needs you to be able to think about them and to find a place in mind. But trauma, your body's natural response is to try and make you forget and to try and ignore it. So if you're dealing with grief and trauma, then the trauma gets in the way of the grief, so you never get to get past it. So there's no point waiting 3 months or 6 months, because actually the trauma's still in the way. And what people need is to have support with that. But I think for me, I think we quite often, what I see kind of quite often with clients when they come is they, like I did, and I will hold my hands up, I wasn't very good as a client. I wasn't working as a therapist at the time. I had taken a break because it would not have been appropriate for me. But I think what people wait until they're absolutely desperate. They wait until they hit the wall, and then they need support, and then they need support like yesterday. And that can be really, really difficult, because then if you find the right person, then sometimes you might have to wait a few weeks and stuff, and you're a bit like, oh, but actually I really want to get started now. So it's about, how do we recognise that we're starting to wobble? And quite often it's, how do we recognise that things are starting to get in the way? Starting to get in the way of our actual lives. You know, is it getting in the way of our relationship with our children? Is it getting in the way of our sleep? Is it getting in the way of our ability to concentrate at work? Is it getting in the way of us wanting to spend any time with anyone? You know, our relationship with our partners, anything like that. And I think that's one of the kind of things that I always kind of think is a bit of a warning sign, is around, is it getting in the way of the stuff that I want to be doing? And that can be stuff from like sleep and eat and self-care, up to, I just can't bring myself to like go out and spend time with my friends anymore because I'm not getting any enjoyment out of it. And I think quite often we're afraid because people think, you know, therapy is for people at crisis point, but actually therapy isn't for people at crisis point. People at crisis point, they need crisis support, not therapy.
Not therapy, yeah.
And it's, how do we get people to come in, like, just that step back? And I also think we miss that therapy can be a really supportive tool, like coaching, for performance, for keeping ourselves well. You know what I mean? I work with clients who I've worked with long term, who we have periods where we see each other more often if they're struggling. We have periods where we see each other less if things are going well. One of my clients referred to me as kind of the equivalent of having a personal trainer. She was like, "What would?" She said, "Like, I pay for a personal trainer," and it's like, absolutely no bother. She said, "Why do I question whether it's okay to pay for a therapist?" So we go through phases where it's more. We go through phases where it's more like coaching, we go through phases where it's more like therapy. But I don't think the therapeutic journey is a straight line, because people will do some of the work and then they kind of go like, oh, I need to pause and let that settle and go away and practice things.
And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because that whole idea of, you know, we wouldn't think twice about an athlete hiring a coach for high performance. And that's where I think the most interesting kind of psychological studies sit, is in that sports arena, because we really get what high performance means. We've got a very clear context of how to strip everything else out, and what focus looks like, and what flourishing looks like, and what teamwork, etc., looks like in that area. And coaching, again, I think people now think more positively about coaching these days than they did maybe 20 years ago when I started out in organisations. Coaching was still fairly new. I think not many people, I think you got a coach if you were at a senior level. You didn't get coaches when you started an organisation. Whereas now we say it's great to start a coaching relationship earlier rather than later. And yeah. That therapeutic relationship, you know, time and time again, the psychological effect of the therapeutic relationship is so powerful. We know that it's such a wonderful thing when it does happen, when you click with somebody, when you've got that great safe space to talk and to work through things. But like you say, I don't think we think of it as something we purchased for performance. We think we purchased it or buy it for fixing.
Yeah. And I think it's funny, because I think we've moved in terms of like coaching being more acceptable and people kind of being happy with saying, you know, I've got a coach and things. But I mean, I've worked with clients who have asked me to invoice them for coaching when we're doing therapy, because their organisation has said that they will pay for coaching, but not for therapy.
Yeah.
And, or sometimes where it's a stigma attached to it, whether it's like, well, actually somebody, it's perfectly acceptable for me to go for coaching, but what will people think if they know it's therapy? And I think that's still something really, really important to be done there, because you're not telling me that kind of people at the top of their game, kind of CEOs and people like that, C-suite people, don't have any issues with their well-being, don't struggle with their mental health, don't sometimes feel out of touch in their relationships, don't sometimes feel like they're on a treadmill and they just can't get off. Coaching can go there with some of those topics, but it isn't a replacement for therapy.
No, not at all. So your career then as a therapist, when did that start? When did you train originally?
So I qualified in 2014. I think my career has been a series of things that have changed. So I started training as a psychiatric nurse and then this chronic health condition came to the fore, and I wasn't able to restrain people. And I worked in a mental health hospital, in a forensic mental health hospital, and that's a bit problematic if you can't restrain people, which is kind of how I ended up coming into therapy.
Yeah.
And that was another slight curveball because I started my training and I finished my training with a child and pregnant. So how to make your master's really difficult.
It is such an intense kind of period of learning, because a master's is you're mastering a whole kind of academic subject and also the practitioner points of it as well. And it's over a short period of women and who go back to university or do a master's in midlife. I couldn't imagine doing it with morning sickness.
Being
pregnant.
Yeah, so it was part-time. So it was 2 years for the kind of qualification part, yeah, and then an additional year for your kind of dissertation.
Yeah.
But a counselling master's is, like, counselling and therapy as a training is really hard going because you've got placement, you've got personal therapy.
2 hours.
Yeah. You've got placement hours, you've got personal therapy, you've got supervision. Mm. The more placement hours you do, the more supervision you need.
Yeah.
Which obviously takes time. You've then got your kind of actual writing alongside that and your actual research and everything. It was fun.
Yeah.
So 2014 I qualified, and then I've kind of been in various different roles.
Mm.
Which I think has given me a really wide breadth of experience, really. Because, like, I've worked in third sector.
Yeah.
I've worked kind of in education. I've worked in a role where I was funded by the DfE, employed by a local authority, paid by the NHS. It was, you know, sitting between different kind of organisations and things. Gives you a really kind of, like, that kind of breadth and kind of helps kind of see what works well and where things haven't worked well and things like that, which is where kind of psychological safety came in for me, really. Yeah. Started when I was in an education role. I was working in a school and I was really proud of the work that I was doing with these individual young people. And, you know, I'd set up a service from scratch. We'd got a way to kind of, you know, evaluate the service. You know, I'd kind of got all these things set up. I'd kind of worked out how to kind of do appointments, so I wasn't taking young people out of the same lessons every week. I'd argued that children couldn't only just miss PE and technology, that they had to kind of go through other subjects, because taking children who are failing everything except those subjects only out of those isn't good for their self-esteem. But the thing that kind of always frustrated me a little bit was I was working with a really small group of children, and there were some things that we could do that if we could just make some small changes kind of in the wider school, it could make a massive difference. And it was like, no, you know, we want you to do that. And I was like, yeah, but actually we'd need fewer children who needed that if we could do a bit of this, and we could do some groups and we could look at some training for staff. No, you're doing a great job here, you stay here. And I kept thinking, like, I'm working with some children who, you know, we've got this great sense of psychological safety in this room, but as soon as they leave, it all falls apart and they can't hold it. And then they're getting in trouble in school, or they're being told they're not resilient, or they're not engaging, or they're being suspended. And it kind of really frustrated me. And kind of things about, like, sharing bits of information. So obviously therapy is completely confidential, but being able to share kind of little pieces of information that would keep a child safe, feeling safe, by which I don't mean kind of they're not safe in school because the doors aren't locked. I mean feeling safe, feeling like I'm okay, I can function, I can think, I can learn. Being able to share those little snippets of information that would make a difference would make so much more sense. You know, being able to do things like talking about mental health in the curriculum. And I could never really get out of that little room. So when the job came up at the local authority, which was around whole school approaches to mental health, I was like, oh, that's where it is. Because there was a whole public health movement about it.
Earlier on, you mentioned whole school approach. And I had a stint being a chair of governors at my child's school. I was a parent governor. And one of the things that I found so challenging was this idea that SEND provision was seen as just as additional for individuals. And yet most of the papers that I was reading and some of the really interesting studies just showed how inclusive we could be if we made changes for everybody. And I think recently on the podcast, I was talking to somebody who said, you know, well, everyone's getting diagnosed with ADHD. I said, well, you know, I actually feel really good about that. I think the more people that are diagnosed or aware of ADHD, the better, because whenever we make an adjustment or a change or support for somebody with something, then it benefits everybody. And I feel the same way about whole school approaches. There's just so much stuff that we could do. Like little things like sometimes schools have weeks that are just so overwhelming, so much activity going on in one week, like towards the end of term. And you think actually there would be children in that school who wouldn't hit a diagnosis for autism or for ADHD, but they might be sensitive to noise, or they might be sensitive to something else. And you think, if we could just have a whole school approach where we can have some different ways of doing things, people can opt into what makes them feel safe and feel comfortable. And that's psychological safety. It's not about saying that Johnny needs this and Sarah needs that. It's about saying we have this and you can opt in if you want to or if you need to.
Well, and I mean, I'm actually a governor in two schools. So my chair of government is at a special secondary school that's got a plus 16 provision. But I'm now a parent governor at my children's school as well. One child school now, at a primary school. And I'm the centre governor. And one of the key things that kind of I always found, because I worked alongside the educational psychologist at the local authority and things, was everything comes back to the idea of what's good for send is good for all. And it's that idea. I always think of it as what is vital for some is really useful for everyone. You know what I mean? And you think about things like a visual timetable. Anybody who doesn't know what a visual timetable is, it's literally like we'll write down everything that's going to happen that day and we'll put it somewhere so that the children know what's going to come now, what's going to come next, and what will come after that. It's absolutely vital for some children who kind of need to know, they need to be able to regulate their nervous system, you know, for autism, things like that. But actually, like, everyone quite likes to know what's going to happen.
Do you know what? Last week, I was on a call with, I'm organising a conference with colleagues this week from the British Psychological Society. And we were on a call, there's loads of us, you know, we're all volunteering and we're trying to work out what we're doing. And we've done this conference every year for a decade or something, you know, it's a well-oiled machine. But we're all talking and I'm just sitting there and I'm thinking, God, I just need to visualise this. So I pulled up a spreadsheet, shared my screen and started visualising like the timetable for everybody. Everybody, no, not one person went, no, this isn't helpful. Everyone's like, oh, this is really helpful to see it. You know, visualising stuff, you know, we've got all of these different sensors. Why aren't we using them more? Why? And the other thing that I don't know how this has happened, but with childhood, I've only just realised how much children are expected to keep knowledge in their head. So my child has so much information in his head that he holds on to. And then I think, oh my God, I couldn't possibly hold on to all of that. And I know I've got systems, and as adults, we create systems for keeping information separate and storing it elsewhere. But I think we do forget how much children do have to hold in their heads and how much they're expected to just learn, and that they're learning every single day. You know, they don't reach a point of like kind of equilibrium, do they, at class? They're always being expected to improve their performance and reach the next level. So it's never an easy place for children. It's just this constant kind of treadmill of, right, you've reached the top of that little hill, get to the next one.
And I think like the way we examine children is really awful, you know, because you can learn to be good at exams. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're good at kind of everything else. And exams really fail kind of SEN children quite often. SEN children are kind of disapplied from exams and things like that. But we've also got, we're asking them to learn things that, like, I remember when one of mine learned to read and they were talking about split digraphs and things like that. And I'm like, I've got an English degree. And I'm like, excuse me, can somebody tell me what a split digraph is? And
I can't help my 10-year-old now with his English homework. I just don't know it. And I've had to just sit there and say to him, you know, learn it. Pass the test.
And there's just some stuff and I'm like, wow, okay. And the levels of things that we're expecting children to learn and know, but not stuff that's useful to know. Because I kind of think the things that were missing when I was at school, you know, things like financial education. Anybody explain what APR is to anybody, or like a mortgage or an interest rate or anything?
Yeah.
No, that wasn't there then. It's still not there now. And it's like, surely we know better and we could probably do a bit more of that. And I think, you know, we've come some ways with things like mental health and around that being kind of covered in the curriculum to an extent and talking about kind of mental illness and talking about coping strategies and things like that. But there is still so much more that we're not doing because we're missing out on so much through things like play. Because when you look at kind of how a child's brain develops, I don't want to get kind of dead technical about it, but when you look how a child's brain develops, one of the things you have to learn how to do is exist alongside other people. Because we're mammals, we're meant to live in community. So you've got to learn how to do things like take turns, share, kind of have ideas in play, but not be over controlling in play so that you can kind of develop a sense of self and that idea of I'll play your game if you're playing mine, you know, and then being able to get into education and being able to thrive in some things, but maybe not others. But then how are we helping children who aren't academically able feel like they're thriving in anything? Because otherwise they're ending up feeling like they've got no skills at like 11. And that's just not all right. Because everything doesn't come down to academic ability. You know, we need other things as well. And I think, you know, the way that kind of the curriculum is run, and that's always like a national problem. It's not, it's a government level problem. It's not the school's fault. But I think that really kind of causes a lot of challenges with children around kind of their mental health, their resilience levels, because they haven't got it and nobody teaches it. And then they haven't got the capacity to provide it for each other either. Because it's just no time given.
There is, I find it really challenging. I think the more I learned about psychology, the closer I was getting to working in the NHS in terms of sitting alongside clinical psychologists and, you know, understanding how people ended up coming into therapy and when was too late and, you know, also just how normal it is to need to talk. And then being a school governor and then seeing how we operate schools, it felt a little bit like I was a drop in the ocean in terms of what I could affect or change. But I feel that by being a school governor, that I have a better understanding possibly or a better compassion. I have more compassion now for teachers around the difficulties in managing a whole school and trying to do a whole school approach when you have basically, you know, hundreds of little minds that are all developing at different paces, spaces and time zones, you know, and then we just have budget problems. You know, it's not cheap to educate children. So I think I've got more compassion. I think as a role, a volunteer role, it was for me the most unexpectedly rewarding role that I've ever done. I couldn't do it for very long. I had to let that one go when I started doing my PhD. But I would encourage anybody, if they get the opportunity, to at least be a governor, even just for a year. You know, anything that you can give helps. And most schools are crying out for governors.
Almost, if you think you've got nothing to offer a school, I think you're probably exactly the kind of person you want, because what we don't want is rooms full of people who all look the same and think the same. We want people to ask difficult questions, who say, like, can I just ask why we're doing this? Because it doesn't really make any sense to me. And, you know, I think it makes such a massive difference. I feel quite honoured when kind of I get to do that. But I think one of the things which really brought home to me is the need for when I was talking about supervision before, that supervision spaces for those people who are in really, really difficult roles, like head teachers, NCOs, safeguarding leads, social workers. I mean, social workers get case supervision.
Yes.
So where you can put down the really awful things that you hear at work.
Yeah.
Because, you know, safeguarding leads, for example, they're going and they're having to make decisions about, do you think this child should stay with their family? And, you know, where do you put that down? You can't go home and like chat to your husband about that, can you? You know, they're the things that kind of you hold. And to be able to look after our own mental health, we need those roles. And I think kind of education and HR are the other roles that I think kind of get given everything. And then they support everybody. And then they have nowhere to put it. And I think that's something that's really important.
I think there's, from what I can see, and certainly in LinkedIn circles, there seems to have been more awareness now in this past 5 years since COVID that important role that HR professionals play and how they haven't been supported to date in, you know, that organisational parenting that they do, which, you know, is quite a
lovely
big
way
role
to think about it.
Yeah, organisational parenting. It's a thankless task, I think, isn't it? So we've spoken, obviously, about your unexpected route into self-employment, how going through multiple losses and grief has really taken you on this trajectory of where you are now. And do you have thoughts about post-traumatic growth as a professional?
I think I have seen times when it has happened. And I think for me, I think I have definitely grown an awful lot as a person since kind of 2021. And I did have kind of a similar kind of experience after my mum died in 2009. But I also want to kind of err on the side of caution of the kind of toxic positivity of, you know, everything happens for a reason, something good comes out of everything. Because at the time, it was absolutely awful. I didn't know how the hell I was going to get through it, other than I had two small children and I didn't really have much choice. I mean, I had a very supportive partner, but, you know, I wanted to carry on going and I wanted to kind of make things work and make things look different for my family. But I think, so it's that kind of balance, really, that I think for some people, traumatic situations can be kind of give people a really massive sense of purpose, give them kind of a real kind of change in their thought processes, what's important to them, all those sorts of things can kind of really lead to them kind of making like really significant changes in their lives. But I never want to kind of come across that I'm saying, oh, but don't worry, you know, something good will come in the end. I'll be fine in the end, because actually there's still days where it's not. You know, and I think I have had kind of that post-traumatic growth, but actually I would swap it all to have some extra time.
I think that's where the psychological research is landing on post-traumatic growth. I think I want to say that the research on this is probably a decade old or longer. I think broad, what I do remember finding really fascinating about it was a construct. Post-traumatic growth was something observed and academic psychologists said, right, we've observed this and we're going to create this construct of post-traumatic growth. We're describing what we're seeing and interpreting, and that's absolutely fine. But then the other side of that argument is that it is a construct and it's difficult to pin down what it is or it isn't and how you measure it. So the measurement of post-traumatic growth is particularly problematic, I think, because how do you possibly measure what growth looks like in terms of trauma? So I always found that quite interesting. I think back to things that I've experienced, and yes, I can think, yeah, I've definitely had personal growth, but who's to say that personal growth wouldn't have happened anyway, because we experience things in our life trajectory anyway. The other thing around trauma that I thought would be useful to just kind of mention is you're an EMDR. Do you want to just explain very briefly what EMDR is and how it works?
It's quite interesting, although there isn't kind of necessarily a single belief for how it works, but it is not magic, because that's the other thing that people come up with. It's like, it's magic, we don't know how it works. There are ways it works. So EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Ironically, it doesn't always have to include eye movements, which means that it's quite a badly named type of therapy. But it is a type of therapy which supports you to reprocess events that have happened that haven't really been stored well in your brains. They haven't been kind of stored and categorized as memories. So it's most commonly associated with PTSD. And it's one of only two types of therapy in the NICE guidelines for PTSD, but it can be used for lots of other things. So I use it quite often with traumatic bereavement, for example. I use it with chronic pain, because there is quite often an underpinning trauma with lots of different things. So I've worked with people where there's been chronic pain, for example, and there's been like a history of domestic abuse within their relationships. And when you start working with the trauma, you start working with the trauma that they associate alongside the pain, you can start to help them be able to manage the pain better. So EMDR basically works, you call it alternating bilateral stimulation. So it's either eye movements going from side to side, hand taps, so being able to kind of utilize kind of buzzers that buzz in each hand alternating, or sound, and you could do sounds to each side. What that does is it kind of encourages your brain to kind of work across both hemispheres, basically. And in doing that, it allows you to make different associations to a memory. So your brain will access what they call adaptive information. So adaptive information is the idea that your brain probably has the answer somewhere in there. And EMDR kind of creates the right conditions for it to access that information. And if you can't access that information, it creates a way for us to kind of feed in information that helps you kind of reprocess that trauma. Because when we talk about a traumatic memory, it generally comes alongside a belief about yourself. So this memory, this experience makes me feel like I'm not good enough, or I'm broken, or I'm too much, or I'm not enough. And it allows us to kind of target those feelings and kind of the body sensations as well. So when we talk about a traumatic memory, it gets activated. And I always think about it as being that kind of sensation of like, oh my God, like it feels almost like I'm back there. I'm not back there. But it feels almost like that, like I'm frightened again. And it helps you to be able to kind of target those different feelings in your body as well as the thoughts.
I find it such a fascinating therapy. And certainly women I've spoken to who've had EMDR as part of postnatal kind of trauma or postpartum trauma, that's where I know it from specifically.
Yeah. Well, I'll send you this a link to a couple of videos that you could pop in the show notes from the EMDR Association. Yeah. That they kind of give a little bit of an explanation of it. But I think it's the idea that it's known for PTSD.
Yeah.
But actually trauma doesn't only exist in PTSD. It's, you know, when we're talking about things like postnatal depression, when we're talking about things like chronic pain or domestic abuse, you know, if you think about it, not every person who experiences domestic abuse is diagnosed with PTSD.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're all anyone is going to argue that they've all experienced trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. And then one thing that I've always wondered, because I think with EMDR, and you mentioned, obviously the name of it is slightly misleading because we think it's about eye movement. And eye movements have very recently psychologically been linked to how we use memory and think. And the reason we know this is there's a condition called aphantasia, which is people who are unable to see images in their mind's eye. So they're unable. Yeah. So it's not an on or off condition. I think there's different levels. Some people have got very vivid memories, some people haven't. And I always wondered, how do we work therapeutically with memory for people who don't have that vivid imagination? And does that affect things like EMDR at all?
So from a research perspective, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
But EMDR, when we talk about the incident, and we always ask somebody to bring to mind an incident, and if you were to run it as though it was happening, where would you press pause? What's the worst moment? But that might be an image, that might be a sound, that might be kind of a smell, for example. So it's not just about kind of the actual image. What the image gives us is a way for us to think about what that means about us. So what's the belief that we associate with that image? So like, I'm not safe.
Yeah.
For example. And then we talk about then where do we feel that in our body? So we're actually working with not just the image, but the thoughts behind it and the kind of the somatics, the feelings in our body as well. So I would imagine that if you were going to work with aphantasia, you would be looking more at kind of sounds, smells, but you're trying to get down to that. What's the thought behind it and what's the feeling?
Yeah. I'm just always interested in those kind of like edge cases. And also, I think when the type of work I do as a coach, we'll often say to people, imagine or visualize. And it's trying to be like that whole approach, which is trying to be more inclusive, which is not everybody's going to visualize or imagine. It might be, what was your sense there?
Yeah. Well, it's like, for example, when I work with somebody who's autistic, I might ask them where they feel that in their body.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily ask them what's the emotion you associate with that.
Because they might not pick up on the emotion.
No, or they might tell me that it's yellow.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's like, where do you feel that in your body? So it's kind of with EMDR, what we're doing is we're kind of altering the standard protocol a little bit, kind of tweaking it a little bit, almost like you would differentiate to teach to a different child.
Yeah.
We're kind of tweaking that protocol a little bit for anything that we can't access.
Yeah. The conversation today has just been fascinating. I mean, it's been so generous of you to share your experience of grief and loss. And I think it's such an important conversation to have and for people to hear. And hopefully, if there's somebody out there who's listening, who's going through their own grief, it will be a source of something where they can go, right, I've got a point to refer to in terms of I know how other people do or don't process grief. There is no rule book, I don't think, for any of these things. It's been fascinating to talk to you about your beliefs and how you work with psych safety and the examples you've given. I can honestly see how valuable your role is, you know, in this self-employed freelance kind of world. And we need millions of people like you to go and fix the world and help and support us.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed our conversation today. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to Psychologically Speaking. You've been joined by myself, Leela Ainge, and Chrissy Orson, who is a wellbeing consultant specialising in supporting organisations and psychological safety.